The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Order. Call the meeting back to order. So we have the Auditor General here to bring his November 2015 financial report, and that was tabled today. We had an in-camera session. We'll begin the public session now, and I'd like to start with introductions from the members, starting with Ms. Lonescroft.
MLA Suzanne Lonescroft, Lunenburg.
Good morning, I'm Margaret Miller, the MLA for Hans East.
Joachim Strong, Halifax, Chivucto.
Good morning, my name is Tim Houston, I'm the MLA for Pictou East.
Good morning, Maureen McDonald, Halifax Needham.
Morning, Dave Wilson, MLA for Sackville-Cobequid.
I'm Ian Rankin, MLA Timberley Prospect, Vice Chair, filling in for the Chair this morning. And we'll start with the introduction with the witnesses, and then you can go ahead with your opening remarks.
Good morning, Michael Pickup, Auditor General of Nova Scotia.
Good morning, Anne McDonald, Assistant Auditor General.
Okay, you may begin, Mr. Pickup.
I'd like to thank the committee for their interest in our work and the questions they are about to ask us over the next couple of hours. I also want to thank the people in my office who produce this work and who do a lot of audit work to get to this point today. Ms. McDonald, who just introduced herself, is the Assistant Auditor General responsible for all of the financial audits that our office does and pulls it all together, and will certainly more than assist me today in responding to your questions as well. We have three chapters in this report based on the various work that we do as auditors of the government's financial statements, as the auditor producing a report on the revenue estimates, and also as auditor of other selected entities. As well, this work pulls together the results of audit work done by numerous private sector audit firms who audit various organizations in the government, for example, Nova Scotia Community College, Nova Scotia Liquor Corporation. They're all part of the government entity, but they would be audited by individual audit firms. But we pull together the results of all of those entities. So we're not going to walk through the reports with you at this time. We spent some time with you this morning going through the individual reports. We do respect that you only got the report this morning, so where we can, and we will link our responses to the pages in the report where that actually works out. So that will be the end of the introductory remarks that I would offer today.
OK. Okay, thank you. So we'll begin with questions from the PC party, beginning with Mr. Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the Auditor General and his team for preparing this report. I want to start off with the some findings around the Gambling Awareness Foundation. And I'm looking at page 44 of your report. Now, the Gambling Awareness Foundation is a foundation that received $1.2 million in funding over the last 2 years, but awarded grants totaling less than $200,000, and none in the past year. So I noticed that the auditors for the Gambling Awareness Foundation raised some concerns that maybe the foundation was not fulfilling its mandate. I wonder if you can just give us some comments on how serious of a statement that might be.
Mr. Pickup.
Part of why we have reported this issue, even though we didn't do that individual audit, is that to suggest an entity may not be filling its mandate is a very significant concern. So it's not for us to question sort of the policy behind why an organization exists, but when an organization exists and is given money to fulfill a certain mandate, and an auditor raises the question of whether that's being done, I would say it is a significant concern.
And when it should be a concern to all Nova Scotians, but I guess specifically the people that sent the money to them to begin with. So what would you expect to see as the Auditor General when you hear something like that? Would you hope that the department that advanced the funding to them takes some action? What should we expect to see now that we know that the auditors have these types of concerns about the organization?
Mr. Pickup.
I think what I would like to see is there are a few issues here. There's the one of fulfilling the mandate, but there's also the issue of the amount of cash that this organization is sitting on, with $1.3 million in checking account and $920,000 owed to the Department of Health. I think, with all due respect to the committee, I think, you know, that is something the committee could look to government to say, you know, the auditors raised this, that the potential exists, the mandate is not being fulfilled, you're sitting on cash, what are you going to do about it, what does this mean? So we have brought this to your attention and to Nova Scotians' attention in order to then allow you to bring it to the people who run these organizations.
So so the foundation owes the Department of Health $920,000. Could we have any indication of why the Department of Health wouldn't be trying to collect that? Would that be something you've found? I assume the Department of Health could use a few dollars and should be trying to collect that money and use it for purposes that are important to the Department of Health. Is it? Do you have any comments on how it could be that the Department of Health would be sitting on a receivable like that and not interested in collecting it?
Mr. Pickup.
I think this is a question that probably should be posed to the department. So we're gathering here, accumulating the findings of a lot of audits in here, and we don't have a lot of more background on this one, for example, because we didn't actually do the audit. So we're just reporting what the auditors reported.
Would you have any indication from your review of the auditor's findings? So if the foundation has the money, but they're not advancing it for the purposes that it's meant to be advanced for, what is it spending it on? Just the salaries and of the management of that organization? Is that where the taxpayer money is going, to salaries and expenses of a foundation that's not meeting its mandate?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From what we understand from the auditor's management letter, it's not an issue of that money being spent otherwise than, there'd be administrative costs of the foundation. It's a matter of the funding it has received through the Department of Health and Wellness and through video lottery profits, that's how the foundation gets its money, not being granted out. So in other words, the mandate is to provide funding for gambling awareness initiatives, and the money is not being provided to entities. We don't know whether or not there were a number of applications that were refused or if the number of applications is down, etc., just from our review of the management letter.
Sure, and I can see from an audit purpose, from an audit to the audit objectives, that would be what the auditors would be looking for. But from a taxpayer perspective, I find it very concerning that the department has sent money to this foundation that's not using it for what it's meant to be. but is incurring administrative expenses, presumably in the way of salaries. It's very offensive to me. But it's not a good use of taxpayer money, particularly in light of the recent cancellation of the MyPlay. So all these things are in my mind and wondering how government feels about the problem of gambling in the province. If they're willing to cancel MyPlay without an alternative, and they're willing to advance $1.2 million to Gambling Awareness Foundation that then doesn't spend it for that mandate, it raises a lot of questions for me as to what the government is thinking in terms of the gambling situation in the province. And I will just leave that for a quick comment. I don't know if it's within the scope of your role here today, but I would say for me personally, as a member of the committee, tying the foundation not spending the money for towards fulfilling its mandate and the cancellation of MyPlay, which increased the government gambling revenues, I see a lot of financial implications to what's happening here, and I see a theme, and I don't know if you share that theme or where you stand on that.
Mr. Pickup, do you want to comment?
Sure. My suggestion would be that, you know, you bring government in and ask them those types of questions. Those really are questions that people running these organizations should answer.
Thank you. I certainly respect that. I do want to talk about the Novastar, and I noticed on page 48 of your report, you do talk about the economic and rural development and tourism incurred $32 million more in expenses, $32 more in expenses than planned, and at that time, of which 11.5 is attributed to supporting the Yarmouth Ferry. Now, we know that there was much more than 11.5 million advanced by the government to support the Yarmouth Ferry, and I appreciate that in the context of this time frame and this audit, that's the impact on the budget. But we now know that it was over $40 million that the province advanced towards the Yarmouth Ferry. And at various points along the when that money was being advanced, we were hearing comments from the Liberal government, from the minister, saying that they were reviewing documents, and they were, I don't know if they used the word audit, but they certainly implied to Nova Scotians that they were being very careful before they advanced money to the operators of the Yarmouth Ferry. We now know what happened and how that carefulness unfolded. So my question for you today would be, in the context of this audit and in the context of your ongoing role, were you ever asked by the department to help them analyze whether or not they should be writing checks to the operator of the Yarmouth Ferry?
Mr. Pickett.
So the quick answer to that is no, we were not. And the longer answer to that, which is probably the more important part of the answer, is from an auditor's perspective, when you would be looking at how things occurred, be it a performance audit or a financial audit, you wouldn't want to cross that line of independence of getting into a situation where you're giving advice on making decisions, which is really a management job and not an auditor job. So any question that would come to us in terms of any issue, and I think back to the Blue Nose, for example, it wasn't about getting in making management-type decisions. It was about analyzing what had happened with an overall audit question of how something was managed.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that the province did have the right to look at the books of the operator of the ferry on an ongoing basis, I guess, probably as wanted basis, if I can make that assumption. Are you aware of any of the department hiring, if they didn't come to you for any guidance, which I understand, are you aware of them going to anyone for any guidance, maybe any outside audit firm or somebody to help them look at the contract, look at what they were being asked to forward, and then make an assessment of whether or not it was appropriate? Are you aware of them,
Mr. Pickett,
going to anyone external?
So I would share with you that the only thing I knew is what was reported publicly in terms of anything that was happening. I never had any discussion with anybody on this matter in terms of accounting firms or other firms that may be involved in this.
I guess I would ask you, as the Auditor General for the province, we know that the minister said on the weekend he was quite surprised to learn that just after the ink was still wet on the final check he wrote to them, he was surprised to learn that some of the assets of the company had been seized. Were you surprised to read that in the paper as well?
I guess, you know, anything I read in the paper, I guess, I don't think of it in terms of surprise or not surprise. It's more, you know, what does this mean? Is there anything there that I should be concerned about from an audit perspective? So I think I've learned long ago not to be surprised.
Too much time around government, sir. I'm learning myself, actually. But in that matter-of-fact approach to learning that news, is this a file that you would be wanting to audit? Because certainly it's a concern to Nova Scotians that after having invested so much real capital, over $40 million, so much emotional capital in trying to get a sustainable service here, it's a big concern to many Nova Scotians. I'm personally, and we've raised our concerns over the long-term sustainability of this service a number of times and kind of been laughed at by the government side. But we are concerned about the way this file is managed, because I imagine if you are sitting in New England or you're an operator or a supplier in Portland and you are learning that companies next door to you, your own company, or your fellow citizens are not getting paid, are kind of getting stiffed, it probably doesn't give you the best taste in your mouth over a ferry service to Nova Scotia, maybe even Nova Scotia. These are the types of things that have concerned us from the beginning. We obviously want a long-term sustainable service there, not managed in the way it's been managed with $40 million gone. So is this a file that you would be, you'd see yourself wanting to have a look at? Will you do an audit of what's happened with the Armis Ferry?
Mr. Pickup.
A couple of issues surrounding your comment and your question. First is in terms of how we select audits. So we look at a couple of key things. We look at, you know, generally the numbers involved in something and how significant it is. So the bigger the numbers, the more inherent it is, more likely it is to be audited. But we also look at qualitative aspects of an issue. So if you look at, for example, the Blue Nose, significant amount of money at, you know, maybe $25 million, but not $500 million. But clearly significant from a quantitative perspective in terms of the concern of Nova Scotians, the concern in government. So the general part of my answer to your question would be, you know, we look at numbers, but we also look at other aspects. And what we do now is we plan our audits, say we do 7 or 8 a year, and we indicate publicly through our website when we're at a point in order to talk about it. So at this point, we have not made a public decision to audit this. If, you know, clearly, if we were to do this, after consideration, it would be on our website. So for now, we are as far forward as June of 2016 in naming the audits that we're going to do and describing what those audits are and publicly talking about them. Until we get to a point like that, we wouldn't talk about whether we were considering doing an audit or not. And the final thing I would add on that is, you know, audits, as I indicated before, audit, for example, how something was managed, we would not engage in a public policy type of discussion on whether or not there should be a service, where it is located, or if it should or should not exist. Those are public policy decisions. How well they're implemented, how well they're managed is fair game in terms of audit. So I hope that is a fair response, if not lengthy, to your question.
It is a fair response, and my concerns certainly rest in the how well it's implemented, how well it's managed, how well it's executed, because I certainly want to see a sustainable service there, a well-managed service there. So for what it's worth, as a member of this committee, I'd throw my 2 cents in there and say, please, can you audit this file? Because it's a grave concern to myself and many Nova Scotians. So I do want to carry on to page 27 of your report, where you talk about the Department of Internal Services. Now, the Department of Internal Services, it says in the report, and we all know this to be the case, was established during the past year and is responsible for vendor master files, you know, everything, a wide range of things, and procurement, is one of the things that the Department of Internal Services is responsible for. Procurement, since this department has been established, has been in the news a couple times. It's in the news very recently with the Tourism Nova Scotia contract. It was in the news prior when there was an issue with awarding of some telephone contracts. So it's a big how the government procures services and goods is important. And I was surprised to read in your report, and maybe I shouldn't have been in the context of at least those two examples that we know. I'm sure there are many more. But I was surprised to read in your report on 2.53 that it is anticipated that business processes related to these services will be developed and formalized by the department. So I take that to mean, and I'd just like your clarification, at the time of writing this report, there were actually no business processes developed and formalized, or there at least weren't sufficient business processes developed and formalized by this department. You put it in this report, and I'm just wondering if you can shed some light around, because it might indicate to me why we're seeing some of the problems we're seeing.
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to paragraph 2.53, this section of the chapter is dealing with our overall comments on a project that's undertaking by Department of Finance and Treasury Board called Internal Controls Over Financial Reporting. And we just highlight that Internal Services is now or will be responsible for various areas. While I appreciate the words would make you think that there weren't processes that had been formalized with respect to all these, that's certainly not the intent here. We did a procurement audit earlier in 2015 and reported on that. And if I recall, we didn't have any significant findings. So I guess the point is that for that project, we're looking to see that internal controls and business processes related to financial reporting at the Department of Internal Services will be developed. It is not that there were not, or we're not aware that there are not formal processes with respect to, for example, procurement. So
it's just around the internal controls over that's procurement.
Well, I guess that could be one thing, but that doesn't mean, as far as we're aware, it doesn't mean that there weren't processes in procurement. We didn't look at that. I mean, again, I point out that we did do an audit on procurement, and we didn't have any significant findings there.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. Continuing on in that same, how am I for time, Mr. Chair?
2.5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. In that same, a 2.56 in the area of government hospitality policy, there is a recommendation that the Department of Internal Services should put in place a government hospitality policy. And I was curious about that because we do know that that's another area where the government was in the news with, I think it was $250,000 of hospitality at a golf tournament. And there was also the Nova Scotia Liquor Corporation. We're going to spend $140,000 on a party, which was subsequently canceled after it was brought up in the House. I forget who brought that up, but it was canceled, I remember. But I have a question about, is that a policy that is now in place as we sit here today, the policy around public sector expectations around how government money is spent on hospitality?
Mr. Pickup?
So the response to the recommendation is that something will be done to put a policy in place that captures public sector expectations. So there is work to be done. There is a hospitality policy, but what we found was that it was lacking. So there was a few deficiencies that we thought should be addressed. So.
Okay. Do you know, just maybe quickly before I run out of time, or maybe I don't, but when senior bureaucrats go on a trip or do some entertaining or something, are they required to write any kind of a briefing note as to what took place and maybe some of the outcomes from that meeting?
Mr. Pickup?
I'm not 100% certain what may have to be done. I know that there are some requirements around, for example, if somebody attends a course or a conference. But those policies are available publicly.
Thank you. Is that it for my time?
20 seconds.
I'll pass my 20 okay. seconds. Thank you.
Time has lapsed for the PC party. We'll move on to the NDP party. Ms. McDonald.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here today. I want to start with the Gambling Awareness Foundation aspect of your report. And like my colleague, who just asked a bit about this, I'm very concerned about what I see here in your report. And I understand that you weren't the auditors of the foundation. So perhaps we could start by helping us understand who the auditors were and how we would get access to a copy of that audit.
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. I'm not sure who the private sector auditors are, but perhaps if you contact the foundation or the Department of Health and Wellness.
Thank you. We certainly will do that. Are you aware that the Deputy Minister of Health sits on this foundation as a member, perhaps even chairs the foundation?
Ms. McDonald?
No, I'm sorry, I'm not aware of that.
I think that actually may be the case, but we will do a bit more digging around that. Now, you indicate that the foundation has $1.3 million in a checking account. It owes the Department of Health and Wellness $920,000. That checking account is earning no interest on an annual basis. It's just sitting there. What would be a reasonable rate of interest that could be earning that we're missing out on in addition to that money just sitting there being unproductive?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. I would say these days, unfortunately, the rate of return is pretty low. And I would expect that an entity like this, as we see throughout government, that they invest in fairly secure instruments such as GICs. So the interest rate is fairly low. So there would not be a big return, certainly a little bit more than what you'd get from a checking account, which would be nothing, but not a great amount.
A few thousand dollars, though, with $1 million?
Potentially, depending on the rate.
Okay. And additionally, your report indicates that no money at all has been awarded from that fund in support of gambling research, education, treatment, or remediation of the effects of gambling in this year. Is that accurate?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. And again, just to emphasize, we're reporting what the auditors reported, so that was their finding, that no funds had been advanced for grants for 2014-15 to address the mandate of the foundation.
Which is very disappointing, very concerning, I have to say. Not so long ago we had, and I think probably you will recall that we had the Department of Health here with respect to the cancellation of MyPlay, and gambling revenues had been dropping in the province of Nova Scotia until relatively recently, the last few years, and after the cancellation of MyPlay, we see a significant increase in gambling revenues. And what this tells me is any responsibility that the Department of Health and Wellness or the Gambling Awareness Foundation would have with respect to investing in responsible gaming has been abandoned. The transfer, the money owed to the Department of Health and Wellness from this fund, $920,000, would that be money transferred into the wellness side of the Department of Health and Wellness, where their addictions programs are?
and to support the research and to support the treatment, the education, the public awareness campaigns that are overseen by the addictions unit inside the Department of Health and Wellness?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we can't discern that from the financial statements. There's just an amount showing as $920,000 owing to the Department of Health and Wellness. So no, not able to comment on whether it relates to the wellness portion.
I, as a former Minister of Health, I think that probably is where that money would have gone. And it troubles me that almost $1 million is sitting in an account when it could and should be properly directed into program development and program delivery for what is a serious problem in our province for some people, and a problem that it appears to lack the attention of the Minister of Health and his department. We will, I hope, have an opportunity to bring them before us to speak to this. I want to talk about the issues around the over expenditures in several departments identified on page 48 of your report, and specifically the over expenditure of $40 million in the budget of the Department of Internal Services, mainly due to $35 million in environmental remediation costs. And I'm wondering if you could outline for us what those environmental remediation costs relate to, and if you could provide, perhaps not today, but after this meeting, with a breakdown of that for us.
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. Yes, actually, I'm aware that $32 million of the $35 million relates to Boat Harbor. So during 2014-15, the Department of Internal Services accrued an additional amount related to that environmental issue. And this is all in accordance with the public sector accounting standard requiring the recognition of that liability.
And is there any portion of that cost that relates to the MV Minor?
Thank you. That I can't tell you, but can certainly find out for you.
Okay, thank you. And in the same light, the increased expenditure in the Department of Health and Wellness and Education and Early Childhood Development, can you shed a bit more light on those over expenditures than that, just that line there?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. I guess what I can tell you is that these increases relate to the consolidated entities that come into the Departments of Health and Wellness and Education. In other words, the amount that comes from the General Revenue Fund for those departments, there wasn't a significant fluctuation. I'm referring to information that's included in the public accounts where it compares the General Revenue Fund budget with the General Revenue Fund results. And so because there weren't significant fluctuations on that side, then it means that on a consolidated basis, the school boards and the health authorities, that's where the variance is resulting from.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Can you give us an idea of the delineation between the Department of Health and Wellness and the Department of Education for that $85 million?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. No, I don't have that information at this time, but can provide that.
Perfect. Thank you very much. I would appreciate that. You indicate that the Department of Community Services was over budget by $26 million, and that this is due to increased caseloads and client costs in the disability support program. When you say increasing caseloads, do you mean increasing caseloads in the disability support program or in the income assistance program, in the child welfare area? The increased caseloads in which program, I guess, is what I'm looking for.
Ms. McDonald?
Thank you. The information that's in the public accounts dealing with this talks about increased caseloads in the disability support program, not particularly with the other child and youth and family support programs.
Can you tell us to what extent there's been a growth in caseloads on a percentage basis or an actual number year over year? Do you have that?
Ms. McDonald.
No, unfortunately, I don't have that information, and we wouldn't have that information. That would be something that the Department of Community Services could provide. And just to make a correction on an earlier comment, actually, the public accounts indicate that in the family programs, there was also increased caseload. So it appears that their explanation is that in both the disability support program and the family income assistance programs, that there were increased caseloads.
I want to just briefly touch on the earlier in the report, the senior government executives' hospitality and vacation use policy. Apparently, there is a policy. I understand it's available. It's online, is it, the policy with respect to expensing these items?
Mr. Pickup.
The hospitality policy is available online.
Can you explain to me the vacation use part of your report here, where you've raised that as an issue as well, travel, hospitality expenses?
Mr. Pickup.
So our two recommendations relate to the hospitality policy and not about the vacation. We didn't report anything on the vacation, but the type of thing we looked at was, you know, carryovers, approvals, this type of regular stuff.
Okay, thank you. Have the Department of Internal Services indicated when they will update this their policy on this?
Mr. Pickup.
Yeah, in the response, they say they agree and they're going to conduct a policy review. I have met with various officials and have, you know, expressed my view that this should be done sooner rather than later.
But there is no
time commitment. However, I think a reasonable outlook would be for April 1st of next year to have this in place.
April 1st of next year. Thank you. That's very helpful. One of the things, and this is information that's been known for a while in your report, is with respect to the province's debt and the per capita debt load for each Nova Scotian, I note, which we've seen before, $15,944. It's the case, is it not, that every time we lose people from the province and our population declines, our debt load for each Nova Scotian, in fact, increases. So I guess what I'm saying is it's not merely an expenditure issue, although it can be an expenditure issue, but it's also a population issue, is it not?
Mr. Pickup.
So you're right, the math would relate to two, right? If it's 100 divided by four people, that's $25 a person. If it's 100 divided by two, that's 50 a person. So there's two issues there, of course, yes.
Does your office at all, in the process of doing these kinds of analysis, look at the population trends of the province and how that contributes to these kinds of metrics and our ability to manage our debt load?
Mr. Pickup.
The resulting numbers that we do, of course, would be the over a five-year period would be the actual result of the population changes, right? So presumably, if you're going to carry less people and the same amount of debt, then that, those numbers are going to go up. So just by doing the calculations, you know it's debt divided by the number of people that you have over a five-year period.
Thank you. I don't know how much time I have.
5 minutes.
I have 5 minutes. Thank you. I'd like to ask you a question from your report around the district health authority reports. You indicate that two district health authorities' expense budgets were inaccurate. You say... I'll just read the report. Two DHA expense budgets are inaccurate. This province will not allow DHAs to budget for deficits. And then further in the report, when that is elaborated on, for example, the Colchester, East Hants, and PICTO are the two health authorities. It was noted that there were several expense budget line items included for comparative purposes on the entity's financial statements, which were budgeted to show significant cost savings. In their discussions with management, the auditors understood that these expense projections had been reduced during the 2014-15 budget process to amounts well below the anticipated expenses for the year, in order to submit a balanced budget to the province, because the province does not accept deficit budgets. I have to say that concerns me, because as a lay person, how I read that is that the budget was adjusted in an unrealistic way, but in a conscious way, knowing that the province does not accept deficit budgets. And I want to ask you, as auditors, whether or not this is a proper way to manage the financial resources of our healthcare system.
Mr. Pickup.
In response to that, just by way of background, as the report indicates, this issue was brought forward based on auditors of these health authorities that previously existed. So now these health authorities have all merged, of course, into one, and the financial audit will be done by us, the Office of the Auditor General, rather than an audit firm. So presumably next year, if there are more detailed questions about that audit, we are going to have the answer. Now, to go back to your actual question, budgets are required as part of the public sector accounting standards for a reason. It's so that people such as legislators and the public can look to actual results and compare to what were realistic budgeted numbers at the time. Of course, with the passage of time, there's going to be differences. They're budget and expected, but I strongly believe that the budgeted numbers should, as a general rule, reflect what you anticipate to spend, not some other numbers. So in answer to your question, yes, I think the budget should present the actual planned expenditures, and if that raises other issues, then deal with the other issues as they arise.
Because my read of that is that the books were kind of cooked in those two district health authorities on those budgets. And I have to say, it gives me confidence, I guess, knowing that the Auditor General's office will be looking at the new health authority, because that's even a bigger amount of public resources, over $1 billion in expenditure in our healthcare system. So it's important that we get a clear and accurate picture.
That's it. Okay, thank you. And we'll move to the Liberal Party for 20 minutes, starting with Mr. Stroink.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I guess I kind of want to get right into it, so I'm going to start looking at page 47 and start our conversation there. So you look at the sustainability portion of that graph that you've put forward, and I guess I kind of want to walk through the sustainability piece of this graph. You look at the net long-term debt, the net debt per capita, you put unfavorable. And I guess, so park that comment for a moment, and I look over at page 50, and I see the graphs that have acquired there to show our net debt and our net long-term debt. And I guess really where I'm trying to get an understanding is this really starts to really take off in 2009, where it kind of puts us into an unfavorable situation with the net debt. And I'm trying to get an understanding. I know you probably haven't looked that far back, but looking at your at the report, do you have any sense of why or how that just started to spiral out of control to increase our debt loads? Do you have any sense?
Mr. Pickup.
We'll give an answer, and then if Ms. McDonald wants to add, she can add as well. Keep in mind what we're doing here is presenting ratios as suggested by the public sector accounting standards as something that you could use. But the ratios reflect the numbers that were the end result of decisions that governments may have made in terms of expenditure, in terms of revenue, and in terms of what happened to each of those, right? So if you go back, that would have been the result of what happened in those years. So it would have been a cumulative effect of all the decisions made over a number of years.
Right. So starting in 2009, it kind of took off. And I guess I want to ask, part of that discussion, I think the net debt, I mean, you brought it up in the past report with the jobs fund, right? So that must play a large portion of this unfavorable sustainability of this province is the jobs fund. Is that a fair assessment to put forward?
Mr. Pickup.
I would say the end result of what a government does, I wouldn't try to isolate to one issue. I would say the accounting at the end is the result of, you know, everything that happened during that year. If that is one aspect and that explains part of a year, then that would tie into the changes in these numbers.
Okay. I mean, that's a fair comment. I guess I do want to go back down. So we've kind of laid the foundation that a lot of the past history is unfavorable, that has ramifications to the future of Nova Scotia, and I appreciate that comment. And I guess what I'm trying to get to is that when you look at the net debt as a percentage of total revenue and annual surplus of deficit, you have favorable for this year, for the one-year trend. Do you have a sense of why you've come to the conclusion that that is favorable?
Yeah, Mr. Pickup. Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. With respect to the net debt in the current year, the main reason for that favorable position and the surplus annual surplus or deficit is that the results of the actual financial results for the province as compared to the prior year, that it was a favorable variance. In other words, last year there was a deficit of $677 million. This year there was a deficit of $144 million. And so that's a favorable trend that the deficit decreased. And as we explain in the chapter, there's two reasons for that, mostly because there was an increase in tax revenue, but also there was a decrease in the pension valuation adjustment.
Okay, but now you're saying that the five-year trend is unfavorable. Is that just because there's so many unknowns that are playing into the factor of the unfavorable piece?
Mr. Pickup.
If I could draw your attention to page 52, the net debt as a percentage of total revenue. So you can see, 147 in 2014, 147%.
Yep.
So year over year in 2015, it went down to 141. Right. So that is a favorable for the year. But if you compare back to 2011, where you're at 129,
yep.
Overall from 2011 to 15, not going the way you want it to go, right?
Right. So that's fair, but it is going down as I see.
Over 14, 15. So
yes.
We say, for the year, favorable.
Okay.
Right. For the longer term, not so.
Okay. So here's my other question then. If you look at the net debt as a percentage of a provincial GDP is stable. So I'm just trying to get to now, it seems like we're moving in the right direction with the favorable, and the stable. So we're creating an economic groundwork for stability within the debt and the province financial situation. Is that a fair assessment to make?
Mr. Pickup.
I think the way to do it is to look at all of these indicators as presenting a picture at a certain point in time based on what's happening. So what I'm comfortable to say is, you know, there are a couple of indicators that have worked well over the last year that show some favorable results. But overall, when you put all of these indicators together across sustainability, vulnerability, and flexibility, there are still some, you know, danger signs in terms of the indicators not being where you want them to be. So it's a mixed message, some favorable signs, but yeah, some still, you know, concerning results here in the indicators.
And I guess you're talking about the danger of the futures of expenditures. And I guess in your opinion and the Auditor General's thoughts on this is that can this province afford to go further in debt?
Mr. Pickup.
So the issue of whether to take on debt and how much debt to take on is really one for a government to make. If a government wanted to cut taxes and expand services, I would not comment if that took debt to do it. I would comment on the end result in terms of what these numbers show. And in fact, we do comment to say these numbers demonstrate that given the resulting indicators, the ability to continue to expand programs or services or cut taxes, given the current level of debt, the amount of people we have and the tax revenues we have, is questionable.
Or irresponsible in some ways. Would you agree to that?
Mr. Pickup.
So I will speak to what the indicators demonstrate. The indicators demonstrate that this is a concerning financial situation, and what we're trying to tell Nova Scotians and legislators in this report is to say, you know, I'm not going to comment on whether, you know, a policy is good or bad in terms of increasing or decreasing expenditure, but I am pointing out to Nova Scotians that the result of doing that is a somewhat troubling financial situation, albeit a couple of positive signs this year.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Ms. Miller.
Thank you very much. Thank goodness for people like you guys who come in here and you can look at the provincial debt, you can look, you know, give us a report like this. It's not something that I could ever do. I'm not that numbers person, although I find that we live our lives more aware of the debt, and it was certainly something that I was always aware of before I got involved with politics and very concerned about. So really glad to have you here and doing this work for us. I think accountability is very crucial to this government. And time after time as MLAs, we've come across that. You know, if something needs to be done, we find, you know, it's not feasible. It doesn't fit in the budget. It doesn't work, you know. So we always have those financial considerations to those things to work with. So, and it should be. I mean, we need to get our house in order, the same as we hope that every Nova Scotian will get their own house in order. So debt servicing is one of our main costs or interest costs. Can you tell me where that sits in the cost? You know, I know what the health department takes the most. Where does debt servicing come in on that?
Mr. Pickett.
So I would refer you to, and I know you only got this report this morning, so you haven't had a week to go through it or anything, but if you go to page 54 of our report, we have a summary of debt servicing costs as a percentage of total revenue of the government, and we do it as a percentage to say, essentially trying to tell a picture here of what percentage of revenue is going to service this accumulated debt that we have. Mm-hmm. And what you'll see in 2015 is it's at 8%, and it was 9% for the 3 years, 4 years preceding this year.
Mm-hmm. So that's money that's gone. I know when I pay personally, when I pay interest, it bothers me. That's money that I've lost. It's gone. And as far as the province goes, it doesn't feed anybody. It doesn't clothe anybody. It doesn't educate anybody. Those are all places where we really needed that money. The same, you don't put a roof over anybody's head. So it pays the costs of government over expenditures, and our government as well. So I just want to really reiterate that, you know, that is a real concern, and I think it continues to be a concern. So I want to finish that off by saying, if nothing changes, if we continue to do things just the way the governments have done, how vulnerable to economic shocks will the government be if we keep doing the same thing as previous governments have done?
Mr. Pickup.
So if we refer to page 47 of our report, and this is partially why we use these indicators that have been developed by the Public Sector Accounting Board, is to sort of put some neutrality in it to say, you know, we don't pick these things. We're not trying to just come up with things. And what these show across sustainability, flexibility, and vulnerability, what it shows is, you know, a very fragile situation, if you will, in terms of the amount of debt and where we stand. I would also draw your attention that maybe more understandable to constituents, maybe more understandable to Nova Scotians, is the table on page 51. On page 51, we show net debt per capita. And in 2015, it's now at a high of $15,944 per Nova Scotians. This is not to pay all your future costs. This is not to pay, you know, hospital care 20 years' time. This is an accumulation of debt for things you've already experienced, things you've services you've already had. So, you know, that clearly, you know, sort of demonstrates an upward trend that is not does not present a good picture.
Okay, we'll move to Ms. Lonescroft.
You know, I'm really concerned about the overall financial health of our province. And it seems that we are trying to get things going and, you know, doing a five-year fiscal plan to get our spending under control. What indicators have you used to come to any conclusion on the path that we're going forward on?
Mr. Pickup.
So the examination that we do here, the indicators, are really an indication of where the province is at a point in time. So this is the result of history up until March 31st, 2015. Where you get some positive signs are things like a deficit that may be lower, some of these ratios that may be turning favorable or give some indication of that. So we've tried to present that picture to people, but certainly we don't give, you know, we don't have a crystal ball to look forward or in any way offer any kind of opinion or thoughts on where things may end up depending on planned announcements and things like this.
So do you see that the provincial deficit of $135 million less than budgeted? Is that favorable?
Mr. Pickup.
So that would be, yes, that would be a favorable indicator.
And so you feel that if we continue on a path of addressing the deficit, that the province should see some change?
Mr. Pickup.
If there continues to be lower deficits and surpluses, then the numbers, just by the pure math of it, of course, will change.
Okay. So, our getting back to what Ms. Miller said, you know, we have our highest expenditure is health, followed by education and community services. Our next big part is paying off our debt. You know, our fourth expenditure in this province is paying off the debt here in Nova Scotia. And if we don't get this under control, we will be seeing our most vulnerable people taking a seat below, paying off the debt. And so how important is it that we keep on this trend of reducing the deficit so that we can focus on education, health, and our most vulnerable citizens?
Mr. Pickup.
So without touching into any policy issues that may go around there and sticking strictly to the numbers, I would again draw attention to page 54 that says what are the debt servicing costs. And you look at 2015, you have a province, a government that's bringing in $10.6 billion in revenue and is paying out nearly $900 million in debt servicing costs, $896. Clearly, that is money that can't be spent on programs or can't reduce taxes or any combination of those two because it's going to service the debt. So we're presenting this as information to say, Nova Scotians, this is what is happening as the result of government action, and this is what the numbers show.
And our programs could benefit by that money.
I mean, with that $896 million, I mean, that is debt servicing costs that if you're not servicing the debt with it, you can
use it for other programs.
You can reduce taxes, increase program spending, any combination thereof, or whatever government would decide.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll move to Mr. McGuire.
There's a lot of questions asked here today. I mean, I'm just kind of thinking out loud. I get confused sometimes with the member from Pictou East and his rural colleagues on their stance on the Yarmouth Ferry. Is it a positive thing? Is it a negative thing? Is it a good investment? Is it a bad investment? I guess that's what you call driving momentum. You talk about the effects of the net debt, which you says places a burden on the economy. And we've seen over the last number of years, in particular with the previous government, we've saw wage patterns that were set that were above norm for a national average, that were, you know, there were provinces that were in a lot better financial state than us that weren't giving wage patterns like Nova Scotia has. I think it amounts to a little over $700 million. And then we saw the job funds, which, you know, last week, that meeting last week really bothered me. I have a 2-year-old son and a 10-month-old daughter, and to be told that they're going to be paying for, you know, secret slush fund meetings that were done behind closed doors for the next 30 years, you know, that really bothers me, and I think it should bother everybody here. So I just want you to elaborate a little bit on those burdens, the net debt and the burden that it'll have on the future economy.
Mr. Picker.
So I would draw your attention again to paragraph 4.15 on page 50 of our report, where we have indicated that the increasing trend in the debt as a significant indicator of sustainability, because the cost of serving the debt takes priority. Right, over funding programs or reducing expenditures. And since 2008, that number has gone up by $4 billion since 2008.
So it's safe to say just those two, the now-defunct job fund and the money committed to wages, which is about $1.6 billion, will potentially handcuff future governments to make decisions that are in the betterment for all Nova Scotians.
Mr. Pickup.
So any pluses or minuses you do that impact any of your expense line items is going to flow through to these numbers, whether they're on the expense side or whether they're on the revenue side, is going to impact the bottom line here.
So I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I'm going to take that as a yes. That's it.
Okay, that's it. We'll move back to the PC party for 14 minutes. Mr. Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and enjoying this discussion this morning. I can tell from the tone of the discussion from my colleagues that they're completely and utterly focused on trying to reduce the expenses of the province. And reducing the expenses of the province it can be a good thing. It wouldn't be a good thing if it's at the expense of Nova Scotians. If we degrade the level of services to Nova Scotians any further, it's not a good thing. So the narrow-mindedness, the narrow-minded focus on that particular part of the issue is concerning to me, because there are two ways you can solve the problems that face the province. And the one that I'm most excited on and that I choose to want to focus on is to grow the revenues of the province. And we haven't seen anything from this government towards growing the revenues of the province. So I guess my question to you is if we want to have if we want to provide better services to Nova Scotians, certainly one way to do that is to grow the revenues of the province so we have more money to spend on services. Is that a simple straight line from those two things? More revenue is better services?
Mr. Pickup.
So I would say there are three possibilities to change the bottom line. One could be solely increasing revenue. One could be solely decreasing expenses, or the other could be a combination of higher revenues and lower expenses. But I wouldn't go on the record to say more revenue into a program necessarily equates into a better program. I mean, that would be depending on how well a program is run and how effective it is, and sort of part of the reason why we do those performance audits that we do of government operations.
Oh, certainly, and I agree with that. We've seen that the more revenue in a certain program doesn't necessarily help. We're talking today about the gambling fund there, and obviously that's revenue in there that's not helping. So, but in terms of the growing the economy part of the equation, I guess when I think of some of the things that have done that have been detrimental to the growth of the economy of the province, I get concerned, and one of them obviously is the film tax credit, which was a move by this government to control costs. Got to control costs. Saved, use that word very lightly, in their estimation, $25 million, but actually has caused significant problems for an industry that was contributing $120 million, $130, $150 million to the economy of the province. So this is the types of mistakes you make when you don't fully understand all the moving parts. So my question for you is, has anyone from the Department of Finance, did they ask you to review their analysis around the film tax credit cuts and what they were trying to do there? Is that something that your department has looked at?
Mr. Pickup.
So a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is no. The longer answer, I would draw back to the purpose and the mandate of the Office of the Auditor General. So as an independent organization, right, an independent officer and looking at the expenditure of government, you know, we have to be very careful not to get drawn into management and government decisions, be they analysis to support a decision or making a decision or contributing to a decision. Right, those are decisions of a government, and similar to the film tax credit that you talk about, we could, you know, we produce numbers here that are the result of the accumulation of a lot of activity, and I would not comment on an individual action, and certainly not on a policy related to that.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And when you look at some of the efforts around economic development, and it falls into has it been a good use of taxpayer money? Has it produced the results? And there's a long history in the province of ones that have failed on that, and the list continues to grow. Unfortunately, we got to stop making mistakes. I was, just as an aside, I was optimistic with the Department of Business. I was optimistic until last week we learned that the Department of Business doesn't actually deal with businesses, which was very interesting in how this government sees the world. But so in terms of the report today, I do want to talk about some of the expenses and some of the benefits that may go with it. You keyed out in your report about focusing on senior management travel expenses. And, you know, anytime somebody's spending taxpayer money, there should be a benefit to it. And I applaud you for trying to shine some light on that use of taxpayer money around expenses and entertainment and stuff like that. Now, you did suggest that senior management travel expenses should be made public, and I think you said that the government agreed with that. Do you expect to see the I think you did, but you can respond. But do you expect to see senior management travel and entertainment expenses published online anytime soon?
Mr. Pickup.
So my preference would be for it to be online, only because I think that's the easiest thing to do, and why not make it as easily available to people as possible. But again, I mean, the decision to implement that and how to implement it is one for government. I'm optimistic that they have accepted the recommendation and they want to do this. I think that's an encouraging sign.
Okay, but they haven't indicated when or how?
They have not indicated. They have indicated that they're going to work on it. My view, as the Auditor General, is that a reasonable time frame would be to have this up and running for April 1st, the new fiscal year of 2016, I should add.
April 1st.
April 1st. Yeah, that's my view. Okay. The government hasn't committed to that in their response, but I think that would be reasonable. We are November now.
And presumably it wouldn't be that difficult, because there's a system now for minister expenses to go online. That same system should be. There's also MLA expenses. There's nothing to recreate. You don't have to recreate the wheel here. It's just a question of doing it. Is that fair? Or?
Mr. Pickup.
Presumably this should be fairly easy to do. I mean, we are a small office, and we started this fiscal year. We started April 1st, 2015, to disclose my expenses and executive expenses online. And frankly, it might have taken a couple of hours for us to get that up and running. But again, we are a small office.
Thank you. Thank you. I think we should all look forward to that. In terms of the expenses of the province, I know we always hear a lot of talk about everyone should tighten their belts and everyone has a role to play. But then when you kind of scratch back past the sound bites, you did report in your report today that the expenses of the province were $200 million over budget. I know buried in there, there's lots of very offensive expenses. But do you have any comments on the fact that in an atmosphere of everyone has to tighten their belt, we do see expenses missing budget numbers? Does it speak to the control processes and the oversight process at all?
Mr. Pickup.
So as part of the financial audit process, of course, we would look at, how expenditures were authorized, whether they were approved, how they were spent. We would not sort of get into a performance audit on why, for example, a certain department spent $30 million more as part of a financial statement audit. In addition, we wouldn't, as part of a performance audit, question a government policy. For example, if I go back to the ferry, we wouldn't say you should or shouldn't. We could look at the economy and efficiency surrounding that. But on a typical financial audit, you're looking for approval of transactions, authorization, this type of stuff, not a performance audit lens on it.
Okay, thank you. Is that something that we could kind of, is there any any of your colleagues across Canada or international that do more kind of performance based analysis, even if it's on specific projects? Is that something we should be doing?
Mr. Pickup.
I mean, we've done it on specific cases. For example, if you take the Blue Nose, the Colchester Hospital, where we looked at specific expenditures, why they might have gone over, lessons learned from that. But again, those were very specific cases. And I think the idea was not to provide a variance analysis, but to provide lessons learned, things the government can do better to improve on other type of programs or costs like that. So my suggestion would be, if you want a variance analysis type discussion, why over budget here, bring the people in who are spending the money and running the programs, bring management in from the various government departments to talk about the variances that they had.
Sure. You did in your report express concern with the number of recommendations that are not addressed and continue to be reported. And that is a theme that we often hear, that recommendations made by your office are not implemented. And I worry that speaks to the overall culture, and sadly it speaks to, I think, a level of respect for recommendations. Do you have any suggestions on how that may be, how we can change that culture? And I guess my specific question would be, where does ultimate responsibility for implementing the recommendations fall? Is it with the minister? Is it with somebody else? Who do you look to?
Mr. Pickup.
A few points in there. Firstly, I would say that, the ultimate accountability depends on the organization that we're dealing with, but clearly, if it's a government department, it's up to the ministers. If it's these other types of organizations, whether they're school boards or the health authority, then we need to look at, who would answer for that? Would it be a board or would it be a minister? This year we made the recommendation to say finance, the Department of Finance, should be tracking what's happening with these recommendations, to say, why aren't they being implemented? Can finance ensure that they get implemented? Probably not. Can they bring attention to things? I think so. Can they work with people? I think so. Can they come in here and explain to you as a committee? I believe so as well, and can indicate perhaps who should be called in to talk about these things. Because we do point out that 68% of these recommendations are carryover, many as back as far as 2009-10. And I wouldn't mind drawing your attention to page 42, paragraph 343 on page 42, where we talk about the revenue from school-based funds. So there's some $41 million that comes in during the year in various fees and payments. And there are several issues across a number of the school boards. For example, the South Shore, Annapolis Valley, Cape Breton, where the auditors of these organizations are reporting issues related to, you know, expenditures that are contrary to board policy, or there's no board policy for the use of these funds, or documentation is limited. This is a large amount of money made up of a lot of $200 and $300 payments across the province. So am I happy that these things haven't been fixed yet? No, and that's part of why we have them in this report and why we're hoping finance can play a role in terms of accountability and the work of this committee.
Thank you for that. And I am just looking at that paragraph here now. So the balance of funds at those school boards held in trust at March 31st is $21 million. So it is a very significant amount of money, and it is disappointing. I share your disappointment that nobody in a position to change.
Order. 14 minutes has lapsed for the PC party. We'll have to move to the NDP party, as interesting as that was. Ms. McDonald.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to go back to the issues around the fiscal condition of the province and the debt load. And you made the point, I think, a very accurate point, that your report is a snapshot in time. And for a certain period of time, it gives us a certain vantage point. But I want to start by helping my colleagues understand that not only is it a short point in time, but it also is focused entirely on our province, and it doesn't really look at the context of that time, what was going on, what was happening in other provinces, what was happening nationally. We all know that our province, like other provinces, have experienced a profoundly difficult period with respect to economic growth. The country, in fact, we just had an election where there was a certain amount of debate about whether or not we're in recession and how deeply we are in recession as a country. And we have now a national government that has said that balancing the budget is not a priority, that in fact infrastructure spending, given the weakness of the economy, in recession or not in recession, is a priority, and that's what Canadians support. And I would submit to you that the snapshot in time that you're looking at, that you've looked at, was also a period of great financial economic turmoil coming out of a recession. And I want to draw your attention to a couple of things. First of all, over that same five-year period, Canadian provinces, 10 provinces in the country, five budgets, 5 years, 10 provinces, 50 budgets. Of those 50 budgets, only 9 in that period of time were balanced budgets. And guess what provinces were able to balance their budgets? The oil revenue-rich provinces in the potash province of Saskatchewan and Alberta. And I'd be happy to table this. This is from the Royal Bank. So it situates Nova Scotia in the pack with other provinces, so that you can actually get a picture of, comparatively, are we an outlier? No, we're not an outlier whatsoever. And in addition to that, I have another graph here, or chart, which shows the net debt of the other provinces during the same period of time. This is also from RBC. So I know we have a tendency to sometimes think that our province is somehow an economic basket case, comparatively, but I want to draw your attention to the fact that, for example, Ontario's deficit or debt grew by $70 billion over the same period of time. Quebec, $31 billion. New Brunswick, a province that's smaller than Nova Scotia in terms of population and their GDP, their debt grew by $2.7 billion over this five-year period, the same five-year period, in where our debt grew by $2.3 billion. So, and again, in fact, the debts of all of the provinces, with the exception of Alberta, went up. And when I look at this, I note that the debt of the province of Nova Scotia is projected to continue to grow into the future. So I just bring this for information purposes so that people can have perhaps a fuller picture than just that specific snapshot looking at our own province and the situation, but to locate it in a larger context or, you know, for some point of comparison. The other thing I want to... So the question I have to ask is, when you look at the growth in the debt over the past 5 years, do you do any analysis of whether or not that increase in debt has also increased the assets of the province in any way? How, you know, how was that money actually spent? What proportion of that debt is a new public library on Spring Garden Road? What proportion of that debt is twinned highways in parts of the province? What proportion of that debt is capital for expanded cancer care facilities? What proportion of that debt is a trade and convention center? What proportion of that debt has resulted in the attraction or retention of nurses and doctors in specialty areas? What are the concrete assets that we benefit from as a result of that debt? So that's a question I have. And I just before you respond to that question, I have one more comment I want to make, and this is more toward my colleague, the member for Halifax Atlantic, who made reference to the Jobs Fund as a secret slush fund behind closed doors. And I want to say shame on that member for saying this, in that the bulk of the Jobs Fund monies that are outstanding will go toward the shipbuilding contract, a 20 to 30 year project worth $25 to $30 billion to the GDP of the province. And that, I would submit, is something that his children and the children of the province, for those families who are not chased out of the province by this government and their policies, will benefit greatly from. But I do want to ask about the analysis of, when you look at, you know, the numbers of debt, to what extent is there analysis that tells us what assets we get, what benefits? Because costs aren't the only thing that occur when you spend public resources. You spend them in the hope that there's going to be a public good that accrues to the people of the province.
Okay. Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. If I understand your question properly, it's whether or not we looked at the makeup of the changes to net debt during the year. And if I look at the public accounts, statement 3 on page 73 of the public accounts, it explains the changes in net debt, including the acquisitions and transfers of tangible capital assets. Further detail is provided in Schedule 7 of the public accounts, which is page 109, and that that shows what was purchased under various asset categories. So, for example, during 2014-15, $176 million was used to purchase buildings, $105 million for machinery, computers, and equipment, and the other significant amount is $218 million related to roads, bridges, and highways. Now, we're dealing on an audit basis just simply with the numbers and the results. We haven't looked at those for any economic benefit, et cetera. We're just dealing with what was purchased and whether it was classified properly.
Thank you very much for that. And I will delve down a bit further into that. I want to share the remaining of my time with my colleague, but I just have a quick question. Is there a difference between good debt and bad debt in the auditing world, or is that kind of a policy issue?
Mr. Pickup.
When we calculate these numbers, it really is to tell a story, to say here is where we are as a result. And a question of whether it's good or bad in terms of where we are, we think that's a dialogue best had between, you know, the people who are elected in Nova Scotia and the people who elect them. And they can engage in that dialogue with this independent information that we provide. As you indicate, it's numbers. It gives a snapshot of where we are. But it certainly should encourage that type of dialogue, whether this is good or bad in terms of what you got for this and what this means where we are and where this places us going forward. We think it sets the groundwork for that.
Thank you. I'll turn the remainder of my time.
Okay, to you have 3.5 minutes. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for the audit and your work, especially on the financial audit, updating this committee at this time of year. I think it is important, as you indicated in your opening statements, that we're going into the session, but it gives us an opportunity as a committee to look at how do we proceed over the coming months to ensure that we're meeting the mandate of the committee. So do you foresee next year doing the same thing on the same kind of timeline so that we are back with what you would, you know, hopefully with a snapshot of how the province is doing so that we can continue that dialogue on where the province is going into the future?
Mr. Pickup.
So we very much moved this work forward from February, advancing it 4 or 5 months to help you do your job. So I'm encouraged by your comments, and I won't look next to me as I make the next comment, but we're hoping next year to even forward this by a week or two. So certainly not to go later.
Okay, thank you. And I think that's important. And one of the key terms I've heard you use is favorable indicators. And I would hope with more recent reports from RBC, some of which my colleague has mentioned, around the growth we will see in anticipated growth in GDP, especially as we see a full cycle or full year with the shipbuilding activity that's going on. We know that that's ramped up over the last number of months. But also the Atlantic Provinces Economic Council has indicated a number of projects that will, I think, improve the GDP of the province. They've indicated a number of projects like the Maritime Link, the Big Lift, or the redecking of the bridge, the shipbuilding, offshore, and then, of course, construction in the cranes that we see throughout the city. All of those, by the way, that were investments made by the previous government and governments, as we know that trying to stimulate the economy is a great way to increase revenue and hopefully address some of the economic shortfalls. So would you agree that indicators, they would be favorable indicators when we have organizations like Atlantic Province Economic Council and RBC shining a light on shipbuilding, for example, and the other projects that I mentioned? Would Would that, in your opinion, be something that would be a favorable indicator that we've turned the corner and we'll see a growth? I think they're looking at, I think RBC, maybe a 2.1% increase in 2006. And one of the things they had indicated, it was based mostly on a 20% increase in major project spending. So would that be considered a favorable indicator, in your view, that things hopefully will look better next year?
15 seconds. Mr. Pickup.
So the very quick answer to that is, you know, for us doing this work on the indicators is a very sort of established approach in terms of how we do this. So, you know, not having a complete crystal ball in terms of what all that may mean is, you know, we will wait and see after we do the public accounts next summer and run these numbers again to say, okay, what do the numbers now show given the additional year has passed?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and we'll move back to the Liberal Party. Mr. McGuire.
Where to start? Shame on me, I guess. I would say shame on the member from Needham for making decisions, being part of the inner circle and making decisions based on politics and votes and not on our future. So they like to talk about how they made decisions based on the Financial Times. And, I agree. They talk about how we were in a worldwide recession and this affected Nova Scotians. But does it make sense that during a recession that you would give out short public sector contracts with the largest raises in all of Canada for a province that is struggling?
Mr. Pickup.
So I won't, that very much is a public policy decision, like any expenditure or revenue item might be. So I won't make a comment on the validity of the question.
And we were hearing a lot of downplaying on, I think it was page 47 of your report, where we have a five-year outlook that's unfavorable. We just heard comments to say, it's really nothing. I mean, it's, but this is real, and this is something that needs to be addressed. Do you not agree? The financial stability of this province. And that to sit back and say, well, you know, it's okay. I mean, the Auditor General report says for the next 5 years, everything when it comes to sustainability of this province is unfavorable. Should this not be addressed? Should these issues not be addressed for the future of Nova Scotia?
Mr. Pickup.
A couple of issues there. I just want to clarify that the five-year trends are looking backwards.
Yeah.
So from 2011 to 2015 and unfavorable trends. So it doesn't try to presume what may happen down the road. Now, in terms of what these trends show, as each of the indicators show, when it says something unfavorable, that speaks to what the numbers demonstrate. So if you look on page 51, and you see net debt per capita having grown from 2014 from 15,659 to 15,944. Okay, that is the result of what actually happened. Whether that makes sense in terms of what was happening in an economy, what a government priority may have been, and other issues, that really is a dialogue between the elected folks and between Nova Scotians they represent. We're presenting this as information based on key indicators that are generally accepted.
But you would agree that going from deficits to surpluses is a positive thing for the future, and getting our house in order, not just growing revenue, but getting our costs under control, both, is a positive thing for all Nova Scotians.
Mr. Pickup.
I would say that if the result of what any government does results in numbers that either increase revenue, decrease expense, impacting the deficit surplus number, increasing the amount of debt, then the resulting numbers, of course, are going to show more positive results. So if more positive results occur, it is the result of either increasing revenue, decreasing expenses, or some combination of that.
And you were given a list of questions in regards to where the money was spent during the previous government's time. I'd also like to add two things to that list. How much of the millions was spent toward now failed business, and how many of millions were spent on targets that were never met? So with that, I will pass it on to my colleague.
Mr. Pickup, response?
We're a little unclear as to, was that a question?
Statement. It's just statement. To go along with the list that was given to you by my colleague from Needham.
Okay.
Any other questions from the Liberal Party? Okay. Hearing none. Would you like to give closing remarks before we conclude?
Sure. The closing remarks will be very short. I want to thank you for your interest in the financial work that we do. No matter what the discussion around a government's priorities and what a government does in relation to revenue and expenses are all based on sort of a fundamental belief that the numbers that governments are using are fairly presented. So without that foundation of fairly presented financial numbers, you know, it would be a disaster. So I want to thank, you know, the entities that we audit and the staff in the office for getting us to a point where we can audit these numbers and give you faith as the people who are running the province and making decisions that the numbers you are looking at are fair and they're not misstated. Let's not underestimate these unqualified opinions, which may not exist in many countries and many jurisdictions in the world, but at least the dialogue that you have and whether you agree or disagree on things, it is based on information that at the end of the day you can count on to say, I know that information is accurate and reliable. So we as an office dedicate a significant amount of resources into these financial audits and believe it is very important, equally as important as the performance audit work we do. And I'm very pleased that you as a committee, you know, bring us in here to talk about this work. And I look forward to hopefully you bringing in some of the entities that we talk about to hold them accountable as well for some of the results that are discussed here. So I want to thank you for all of that.
And thank you to the witnesses for coming in today. So we have one piece of committee business here, just correspondence from the Department of Internal Services. The members would have received that. That was resulting from information requested at the September 30th meeting. And the next meeting date will be November 18th, and that will be, once again, the Office of the Auditor General. We are now adjourned.